Okay, thank you very much. So it's a pleasure to be here. And like everybody else, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk about this. I already got a lot of stick about my title, about pre-thermalization, thermalization. It still generates a lot of emotional responses, apparently. So I hope I can explain more or less precisely what this is about. So now, the second part of the talk will be about two joint works with some of my former students, in particular, so Bruno Pattini, who is now at CISA, Neil Robinson, who is now at BNL, and Stefan Goa, who is still with me, and two external collaborators on the first work, Stefan Kerrein and Salvatore Manmana. Okay, so the plan is as follows. So I start with just a very brief, well, definition or review of the kind of problem I want to consider. So that's very general. So I tell you what I mean by a quantum quench in an isolated system. And then I'll try to give you a reasonably precise definition of what happens after such protocols at late times. So these isolated many-particle quantum systems relax in a particular way, and this relaxation works very differently for integrable, non-integrable models. And there have been already quite a few talks about this in the program and also the conference, so this is basically just to set the stage. Then I will come to the real gist of the talk. So the relaxation is very different for integrable, non-integrable models, so I want to ask the question, what happens if I take an integrable model and I perturb it a little bit? Yeah, and then I'll show you a particular example. What happens then is certain remnants of integrability remain in the time evolution of the system. And in the first part of the second part of the talk, I'll describe you a little bit how to characterize this behavior. And then the final part is about what happens, or what do we believe happens at very late times, where we believe non-integrable systems thermalize. In a sense, I'll define for you. So given the fact that we have 15 minutes for questions, so I ideally let's absorb this during the time of my talk, so just interrupt me at any point and ask questions, make comments. Well, they shouldn't hold back until the very end, you know, if they have a pressing question. Okay, so now what are these quantum quenchers in isolated many-particle systems? So the basic idea is quite old now, and I'm sure most of you know this very well. So we take a quantum many-particle system with some Hamiltonian, which, for the purpose of my talk, should have no randomness, should be, well, translationally invariant, or at least translationally invariant on a lattice by two sites, or three sites, four sites, and should only have short-range interactions. Okay, so then what we imagine is we prepare the system in some density matrix that is not simply a superposition of a small number of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, because if you were to do that, it's boring. And you get in lots of fights with Paul Wiegmann, who likes this particular scenario, but he's not here today. So this is not the situation any of us is interested in. So this density matrix should not have a simple relation to the eigenstates of the time evolution operator. And this is a generic feature of quantum quenches. So if you just do any reasonable protocol, this will always be the case. Now, this density matrix, moreover, should fulfill cluster decomposition and also be translationally invariant. Then, given this initial density matrix, you simply can solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation and work out what the density matrix at time t is. My Hamiltonian, by definition, is time-independent after for all positive times. So formally, this is the solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. This is the state, the density matrix of my system at time t. And if I have that, I can now study the time evolution of local observables. Yeah, so just the trace of the density matrix with some operator that acts non-trivially only in a local small part of the system in the thermodynamic limit. And that's very important for me, so I'm not interested in finite systems. So that's a quantum quench. So now, the immediate question is, given the fact that we are considering an isolated system, so there's no bath, yeah, there's no coupling to an environment, is there some sense in which the system may relax at late times? Yeah? And it's quite obvious, because it's an isolated system, it can never truly relax as a whole. To see this, you can simply prepare it in a pure state. Then the system will be in a pure state at all times, yeah? And a pure state can never be the same as a mixed state. And in particular, you can always find, explicitly construct specific observables that never will relax. However, what can happen and does happen is such systems relax locally in space. So the idea is very simple. You take your entire system. Let's say this would be a two-dimensional quantum spin system or something. And you bipartition it into a finite subsystem B and its complement, which I then take to be infinite. So A is infinite and B is some finite interval of a quantum spin chain, for example. And what I do then is I ask questions only about my subsystem. So I basically do measurements only in my finite interval of my quantum spin chain. And more specifically, so I only consider expectation values of local operators, so operators which act non-trivially only in my subsystem. What turns out is such expectation values can and do at late times become time independent. And that's what I mean by local relaxation. And the physical picture simply is A acts like a bath for B. Yeah? So probability can leave the subsystem, and because this is infinitely large, basically never come back. So let's be a little bit more formal. Okay, subsystems, as you all know, are described by reduced density matrices. So the reduced density matrix after my quantum quench is simply obtained by taking the density matrix of the entire system, yeah, and tracing out the complement of my subsystem. So that gives me the reduced density matrix in the subsystem. And now here's the definition of local relaxation. I say the system relaxes locally if the infinite time limit of this reduced density matrix exists for any finite subsystem B in the thermodynamic limit. That's the definition of local relaxation. Yeah? And in this sense, isolated many-particle quantum systems with purely unitary time evolution relax after these quantum quenches. Okay, so now if these systems relax, the next question is, okay, so that means there is a steady state. Now let's define what we mean by that. So we say a density matrix rho SS describes the steady state of the system, and the whole system once again is the finite subsystem and its complement, that relaxes locally if the reduced density matrix of this density matrix rho SS agrees, is the same as the reduced density matrix of the time-evolving system for any finite subsystem in the thermodynamic limit. Okay? So once again, what you have is you have this time-evolving density matrix rho of t. Okay? So now what I said, let's take an arbitrary finite subsystem, calculate the reduced density matrix. So that has a limit, a finite limit, when the time goes to infinity. So that's rho b of infinity, if you want. Now, if you can find a density matrix time independent that reproduces this reduced density matrix for an arbitrary subsystem B at infinite times, then you say this density matrix describes your non-equilibrium steady state. That's also a definition. Now, I should warn you straight away, density matrices defined in this way are not unique. So there's always more than one description, but they're equivalent. So this is very similar to what you have in equilibrium stat mech, where you have grand canonical ensemble, canonical ensemble, microcanonical ensemble. OK, so that's what we mean by steady state. Now, the next question is, if I now actually do one of these quenches, what kind of steady states can I produce? OK, now in order to understand non-equilibrium steady states you can produce, you should consider the role of conservation laws. Now, you always have one conservation law, and that simply is energy, because the system is isolated. Energy is always conserved, and that's simply because the time evolution is purely unitary. So this is your time evolution operator that obviously commutes with the Hamiltonian, and that tells you energy is conserved at all times. Now, if there are no other conserved quantities, it is believed that the system thermalizes in what I precisely mean by that, I discuss next. And this was proposed now quite some time ago by Deutsch and Mark Stradnicki, who's actually here. In this subsystem formulation that I'm using here, what we mean by thermalization is the following. So we define a Gibbs ensemble. It's the usual Gibbs density matrix. H, once again, is our Hamiltonian that I had on my first slide, so the Hamiltonian that describes my many particle system that describes time evolution. And here I have some inverse effective temperature. This inverse effective temperature is not a free parameter, so we fix it by basically imposing that the energy density in the system, which I simply get by tracing the initial density matrix with the Hamiltonian, so that's the energy density in the system. And now we simply require that this ensemble here reproduces the correct energy density in the system. That fixes what beta F is, so no free parameter. That tells me precisely what this density matrix is. And now, if I have a quantum quench in a system which has no other conservation law but energy, but the Hamiltonian, then at late times it reaches a steady state which locally is described by such a Gibbs ensemble. That's what thermalization means. Okay, now if you have further conserved quantities, and this is of course where I want to go because ultimately I'm interested in integral systems, then it's clear a priori that the system can never thermalize, because if the system thermalizes, all the information about the initial state is lost except the energy density. Now, if you have other conservation laws, you have further conserved quantities, and the system at all times knows that these quantities are conserved and take specific values which are fixed by the initial state. Okay, so it's clear if you have conservation laws, you cannot thermalize, but something very similar happens. So now, conserved quantity simply means these are local operators that commute with the Hamiltonian and commute with one another. Because they commute with the Hamiltonian, they're conserved under time evolution. And if you now have such conserved quantities, all you have to do is you have to form what's called a generalized Gibbs ensemble, and this was proposed by Marcos Rigol and collaborators in 2007. So instead of just putting the energy here with some Lagrange multiplier, you put all the conservation laws with Lagrange multipliers, which you then fix by imposing that the initial values of these conserved quantities are correctly reproduced by this density matrix. So that's a necessary condition. Yeah, that gives you the same number of equations or conditions as you have parameters, these Lagrange multipliers, and it's in general difficult to solve this, but this is something you can do, at least for many examples. Now, what happens if you have these conservation laws? The steady state, which is reached at late times, is described by such a generalized Gibbs ensemble. Yeah. I'll come to that on the next slide. Okay. So now, what do these operators look like? So now, let's look at the case where we have an infinite number of them in the thermodynamic limit. So let's look at a quantum integral model. So these have an extensive number of local integrals of motion. Yeah. So these commute with another, commute with a Hamiltonian. And let me give you a specific example. So let's take as our Hamiltonian this transverse field Ising chain. So the Hamiltonian is given here. Let me explain some notations. I define operators as j, j plus l alpha beta, by basically having some Pauli matrix at psi j, a different Pauli matrix by at psi j plus l, and a string of sigma z's in between. Yeah? So this is just the notation. And then the Hamiltonian of the transverse field Ising model is just given this here. So I have a magnetic field in z direction. And I have a sigma x nearest neighbor interaction in this term here. So that's my Hamiltonian. It's clearly extensive. And now you have infinitely many higher conservation laws. There are actually two families, which you can easily write in terms of these quantities. So the next one here, you see, has a density that involves spins on three neighboring sites. Yeah, and then the next one will involve spins on four neighboring sites, five neighboring sites, six neighboring sites, and so on and so forth. And this is a typical structure you have in integrable lattice models of spins. So, yes?
In your case, I mean, you know, these conserved fields commute in minus each
other. Yes. Well, okay, so you could have such a situation, but this is not really what I need. Yeah, so I really want to work with a situation where these are compatible observables, because the general idea is you use them to characterize the macro state that you reach at late times. And in order for this to happen, ideally, so they're compatible. They're like quantum numbers, good quantum numbers of the system. Yeah. And if they don't commute, they're not good quantum numbers. So I don't want to discuss that case.
I see the local in the sense that there's some local operators.
Yes.
Each integral function itself
has X number. Yeah. So OK, this is a terminology. I did not invent this. This is terminology in the theory of integral models. So these guys are called local conservation laws because they are sums of local operators. Yeah, the density is local. Now, why is this important? Yeah, it's actually important, and this is where the term comes from. Well, any Hamiltonian has an exponentially large number of non-local conservation laws. So take any Hamiltonian, solve the Schrödinger equation, or imagine solving the Schrödinger equation. So then the one-dimensional projectors on the energy eigenstates are, of course, conserved. But they're neither extensive nor local. Yeah, and so which distinguishes them in a kind of like completely qualitative way from these. Yeah, and I will be interested basically in such cases, yeah, extensive conservation laws, yeah, so eigenvalue scale with system size, if you wish. And the densities are local operators. Okay. Okay. Now, all of this is still just introduction. Now, I've told you something about integrable models. I've told you something about non-integrable models. The non-equilibrium evolution of integrable models is very, very different from that of non-integrable models, according to what I have just told you. Because non-integral models actually relax locally to generalized Gibbs ensembles, whereas non-integral models thermalize, so they relax to Gibbs ensembles. Yeah, and they're very different ensembles. Yeah, and so the physics you're shaking your head, but I'll show you some examples. I mean, the okay. So they're very different. So there's a marked difference between integrable and non-integrable as far as the steady state is concerned. Yeah, it's really dramatically different. Now the question I want to ask, well, what happens if I add a small perturbation to an integrable model? Yeah, so this is a very interesting question from a purely theoretical point of view, of course. But as we already heard yesterday, so this is important also for, well, let's say, potential applications. Because in the cold atom context, some of the models that are used to describe experiments are close in this sense, let's say, to integral models. So it's an integrable Hamiltonian plus some extra terms. Yeah. And now if you want to know whether you can use the integral model to describe an experiment or whether it's really drastically different, basically you have to answer this kind of question. Okay? Now, let's think about what we should expect when we add a small perturbation to an integral model. So, my first guess, and I guess that would be the same for you, would be the steady state, because the model is not integrable, should be thermal. So at infinite times in the thermodynamic limit, I should thermalize. However, at finite times, there could be a proximity effect, in quotes, and what that basically means, if I look at the time evolution of the system, there could be a transient where the system remembers that it's close to being integrable. Yeah? And then there would be perhaps some finite time, so some crossover scale, after which you really would enter the basin of attraction of this thermal behavior here. Okay, so this is the proposal, and a lot of people have studied adding small perturbations to integral models, and have supported such a scenario to a certain extent. Okay, so this is basically what we want to investigate. Now, in order to understand what we mean by these remnants of integrability, I'll now consider a particular example. Yeah, and the example was something we did a couple of years ago here with Stefan Keren, Salvatore Manma, and Neil Robinson. Now, okay, so because I studied really a non-integrable theory, yeah, you shouldn't expect too much, because obviously I can't solve it, nobody can. So in order to be able to do something non-trivial, we study the simplest integral model available, namely a free theory. Okay? Not because I want to, but this is the only thing I can do at the moment. So then we want tunable parameters, at least two. I want one tunable parameter which allows me to induce non-equilibrium evolution within an integrable theory. So that will give me some quantum quench, observables will relax to a generalized Gibbs ensemble. And then I will have a second parameter which I then switch on top of the first, and then I compare the two time evolutions. So that's the idea. You have an integral quench, you know, which goes to a GGE at late times, and then I compare this to a weakly non-integrable quench. Okay, now the model specifically is the one I've written here. So I have a tight binding model of spinless fermions on a one-dimensional chain. So this is just fermions hopping along a one-dimensional chain. I have a two-sublattice structure, yeah, because I stagger my hopping amplitudes. So I have one here and a different one here, and so on and so forth. So I have translational invariance only by two sites. But this is still a very simple free theory. And then I add to this nearest neighbor density-density interactions. And the entire model is non-integrable. So if u is equal to 0, it's a free theory. It's just quadratic and Fermi, so that's integrable. And then I add the density-density interaction. It's non-integrable. OK, so now let me start with the free theory. So I set u equal to 0. So then I can just go to momentum space and diagonalize this. So I define new momentum space fermionic annihilation operators through this equation here, where gamma are some coefficients. And in terms of these fermionic creation annihilation operators, I can diagonalize the Hamiltonian. I have two bands of fermions, so two species, because simply I have translation invariance only by two sides. Okay, not by one side. That's why I get two bands. Okay? And now let's first consider a quench in the free theory. So what we do is we prepare the system in the ground state of this free fermion Hamiltonian at a particular value of this staggered hopping. Okay? And then at time t equal to 0, we quench, so we suddenly change this staggering parameter, this parameter here, from its initial value to some different final value. Okay, and the observable we look at is just a single particle Green's function. So this is my time evolving initial state. So here my initial density matrix is just a pure state. It's the ground state of this particular Hamiltonian. And the observable is just a single particle Green's function. And here are some results. So I take as the initial value of the staggering parameter 0.75, as the final value 0.25. It doesn't really matter what you choose here. And then here I show you the Green's function as for different distances between these two operators here on the lattice as a function of time. And then what you see is initially you have some oscillations of this Green's function. Eventually you settle. Yeah, you settle to some time-independent value. And this time-independent value is described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble in the sense I've just described for you. And you can actually show in this case you relax like a power law in time to this steady state. OK, so now it's a free theory. So what you can show for free theory, these local conservation laws in the sense I've defined for you before are actually equivalent to mode occupation numbers. So if I just define the number operators for my two bands of spinless fermions, these by definition commute with the Hamiltonian and commute with one another. And what you can do, it's equivalent to what I showed you before, you can write this generalized Gibbs ensemble simply in terms of these mode occupation numbers. Okay, and that describes the steady state reached after this quench. Okay, so this is all very simple. Now, for this quench, I've considered here.
It's a local k-space.
I told you it's equivalent to the local ones. So always think in terms of the local conservation laws. It's just more convenient to do a basis transformation to these for reasons I'll show you in two slides. Yeah. Okay, so it's just for a free theory you can do this. Believe me, it's one to one. Yeah, they're linearly related. It's quite straightforward. So now this GGE, and this comes back to something I said before. This steady state is very non-thermal, so you can see this essentially. Okay, so you have these Lagrange multipliers here. And these mode occupation numbers, you can do the same for a Gibbs ensemble, yeah. And now what you can do is you can compare this generalized Gibbs ensemble to the corresponding Gibbs ensemble, which you choose to have the correct energy density. And what you see, the two ensembles are very different. So this would be the Gibbs ensemble that reproduces the correct energy density, but not all the other conservation laws. This is the mode occupation number for one of the bands. That's the mode occupation number of the other band as a function of momentum. So this would be thermal. And what actually describes the steady state is this one here. You see, they're very, very different. Yeah? So the steady state for this very simple free fermion quench is very non-thermal. OK, now, so this is all still very boring. Now, let's break integrability through interactions. So now we do the same thing, but our quench, we change suddenly this dimerization parameter, but we also switch on the interactions. So now the final Hamiltonian is no longer integrable. And we look at the same observable. And then what we did in the first paper, we used two methods to basically study the time evolution after this quench. One is numerical, so time-dependent DMRG, which basically gives you exact results, or numerically exact results at short and intermediate times. And then the second method, I'm not going to go into any detail. It's a non-equilibrium version of a method of continuous unitary transformations. If you want to know how that works, you can ask me afterwards. So this was developed by Merkel and Kerrine initially. So that allows you basically to go to very late times as long as u is sufficiently small. And so here now is the Green's function at a particular separation as a function of time for this non-integrable quench. And you see what happens is you have oscillatory behavior, but eventually you settle. Yeah? And these two methods give perfectly coinciding answers at these times. Okay, so which basically tells you this method works. And now you can use this method to understand a little bit to what values you settle here. So what is the steady state that describes this non-integrable quench? So using this CO2 method, first of all, we can show you approach this steady state still in some power law fashion. And the steady state itself is, in fact, not thermal. And it's not a GGE either. Yeah. So basically now on some very, very long time scale, the system settles to some values. And these values are neither thermal nor described by a GGE. Okay? So that's what I mean by a remnant of integrability. Yeah. I have zero free parameters in anything I do.
No, I'm saying you want to fit some constant values to an ensemble that is specified by parameters, right?
The parameters are completely specified through the initial condition. I have zero free parameters, zero. And this is crucial. So I know I'm not thermal. I know I'm not a GGE.
But if you are allowed to do that, obviously.
Yeah, well, okay, but this is not the game. Yeah, so this would be... Yeah, it would be the GGE of the free system. It's not that. It's not thermal either. So what is it? Okay, so first of all, this behavior that you settle to something which is neither thermal nor a GGE, this has been given a name by Merkel-Kerrine and people. It's called a pre-thermalization plateau. Yeah. So what's shown there is the difference of this observable from its infinite time value as a function of time. So it will go to zero, so this is a log scale. So it basically goes to zero like t to the minus 3/2. Yeah. So you settle to this plateau value in a power law fashion. OK? Sorry?
Oscillating.
Yeah. OK, so I'm doing OK. Now, what is the statistical ensemble that describes this pre-thermalization plateau? So now here, yeah.
So the plateau is before the power law?
No, so the way it goes, well, just wait. So the way it goes, so this is quite important. So as a function of time, right? So you basically oscillate around some value, and the envelope decays like t to the minus 3/2. Yeah? And this happens on some time scale, which is the one I can access with this method. OK? So you basically can say, if I wait long enough, I come arbitrarily close to this value. Yeah? But then what happens out here is the second part of the talk. Yeah? So I'm still at intermediate or early times. Okay. Now, but what describes this pre-thermalization plateau? So the idea once is actually not very difficult. So what we did is you can construct some operators which are deformations of these mode occupation numbers. You basically dress them up by interactions. And this is something the COT method basically gives you for free. Now, what's the physical interpretation of this guy? Well, these are simply quasi-particle occupation numbers. So if you put on the interactions, what happens is the stable excitation, the long-lived excitations are quasi-particles, which are the free fermions dressed by interactions. Okay, so they now, in a perturbative sense, in my small parameter, they commute with one another. They, in fact, do not commute with the Hamiltonian. So this is the difference to what happens in a generalized Gibbs ensemble. That means these charges are, in fact, not perturbatively conserved at the operator level, but only in a weaker sense vis-a-vis the density matrix that describes the time evolution. But now, once you have these mode occupation numbers, you can define a density matrix, which we call a deformed GGE, yeah, and fix the Lagrange multipliers in the same way you fix them for the free theory, for the GGE, by just looking at the initial state basically say that this ensemble should reproduce the correct expectation value that you know from the initial state. And then what you find is this ensemble actually reproduces the plateau in a perturbative sense. Yeah, not only for this Green's function, we also looked at actually the four-point functions. So this is not so trivial. And the belief is, although to show this is very, very difficult, that this picture works also in higher orders of perturbation theory. We basically showed this in the lowest non-trivial order of perturbation theory. We believe it actually carries over to higher orders in perturbation theory as well. And that would describe now this pre-thermalization plateau.
What are you putting in the GGE plateau?
Well, okay, so because it works. Okay, so the because of the physical picture, right? I mean, so what you want is you want an ensemble, you want some density matrix which reproduces these plateau values. Okay, now why did I write this density matrix? Well, because what I was thinking, okay, so these are these Q alphas are quasi-particle occupation numbers, yeah, and on the plateau, they are conserved. The Hamiltonian is not part of that ensemble. You do realize this. Yeah, so the Hamiltonian does not go here. These are just the mode occupation numbers. Yeah, and the picture you basically have is now you want to describe a macro state in terms of these quasi-particle excitations. So it's a very natural thing to do. I'm sure you would agree. Yeah. Let me come to longer and longer times now, which is the real action.
Before we go to longer times, I do remember what you say, but it's really true that COT can probably, if it's not automatically true, that it should go to this example. If you make longer DMRG and you see this is up to COT. This could be another.
No, no, just a moment. Wait, yeah, no, I understand the question. So COT is COT. Okay, so you're a non-believer, that's fine, it's because you're not German. So how do we know that this correctly reproduces the plateau values? Because we compared it to TDMRG.
Okay, so that was the point.
Yeah, that's the point. This is how we know it works. So actually, the plateau values are given both by TMRG and the COT, but the COT gives me analytical control over what's going on, which is why I can do these calculations. Yeah? Okay, so now that was the first part. So these pre-thermalization plateaus. So Joel kind of frowns, but okay, so you don't like pre-thermalization, what about pre-thermalization plateau? is okay. Yeah, I'll talk about that now. So there seems to be plateaus immediately, in some sense, I'm coming to now. Okay, so this we understood a couple of years ago. So then we were asking, well, that's all very well, but at late times, clearly something else has to happen. So now, can we do better than this COT, TDMRG stuff? And then it turns out, yeah, you can do a fair bit better. So now what we did in this work here, we basically take the same model or variant of the model I just showed you, but now study it with a different method. So we still prepare the system in some initial density matrix, and this is quite important now, in which I have a Vick's theorem. Yeah, this is important for me. So what I did before, I had a Vick's theorem. It was automatically there because I prepared it in the ground state of some free fermion Hamiltonian. Okay, now what I want to do is I don't want to use COTs or TDMRG. I will study time evolution using equation of motion methods. And I'm going through what I mean by that in a moment. And we were not the only guys who were thinking about this. There were also some other people doing similar things. Okay, so now the idea for applying this method is as follows. So this method is not a theory of everything, but it gives you something. So now I've shown you in the previous slides, so there are some remnants of integrability, and I've argued on general grounds that late times it should thermalize. Okay, so now with this equation of motion method, what we believe, you can access some time window which is large enough to give you access to this crossover scale, and then eventually it breaks down. And it breaks down because some of the terms I will throw away on the next slide actually become important. And then eventually, the approach to late times, to thermalization, is given by something entirely different. Some noisy hydrodynamics or who knows what. Yeah. So I will not be able to get really to the thermal regime, but I will be able to go off this pre-thermalization plateau. Okay, now, what are these equation of motion techniques? So it's very simple. So you look at the mode occupation, let's just look at the fermionic creation and annihilation operators of this free fermion part of the Hamiltonian that diagonalize this. And then I look at all bilinear terms which have one creation, one annihilation operator. So the models we consider all have a U1 symmetry, yeah, which is why I don't have to consider AA and A dagger. Okay, then what we do is we simply write down equations of motion, Heisenberg equations of motion, for these operators. Here they are. You work out what you get. Okay, so you have a quadratic piece, and then here you have a quartic piece, which comes from the interactions. Okay, and now, so here's the quartic piece. Now you do the same, so you look at the equation of motion for the quartic piece, so it's given here, so you produce some more junk. And now you could go on until you die. Okay, now, what you have to do is you have to close the system, so that's a standard kind of procedure. Now, in order to do this, we integrate the second equation in time. So the one for this quartic stuff, we integrate it in time, and then take the expectation value with respect to our initial state. Yeah. Now that gives me some differential equations for some functions. Okay, so these are functions now of time. This is the time derivative, and here I have some junk on the right-hand side. Okay, all the action in a sense is. This is not time dependent, okay, but the action is here. Now, these are basically 6-point cumulants and 4-point cumulants, which are here. And what we do now is we decompose it into the disconnected parts and the connected parts. So we separate off the higher cumulants and then drop them. And just retain here the disconnected parts. Okay, so this is a standard procedure. The justification, in a sense, is my initial state is such that these cumulants are initially all zero. And then you can hope, well, for a very long time, they will be small until they eventually build up and kill you. Okay, so now you do this. This gives you this equation of motion. which is some complicated system of integral differential equations. Yeah. They involve now only these functions n alpha beta of k and t, but you see they're highly nonlinear and they involve integrals in time and so on and so forth. Now, those of you who have worked with kinetic equations before might now ask, well, you know, can I reduce these to some kind of quantum kinetic equation, so get rid of these time integrations? And it turns out the answer is no, in general, because the structure is different from what you have for Boltzmann. You can do it only in special cases. So in some cases, at sufficiently late times, you can reduce these to some quantum Boltzmann equations, but not in general.
This is an important point. So
yeah.
If you were in three dimensions, and you work with weak interactions, we know Fermi liquid works.
Yeah.
And Boltzmann equation works.
Yeah.
So what's so different here? It's also fermions, weak interactions.
Yeah.
What's different?
Well, it will work. I mean, I'll show you in a moment. Nothing.
But I mean, just one dimension is sufficiently different.
I think the difference is actually that we are in one dimension.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. One D is
important. Yeah, yeah, but just.
Especially for kinetic theory somehow, right? And so you know, one has to be more careful in terms of.
So you're asking why am I worried about the higher cumulants?
No, you told me Boltzmann doesn't work. That's what you told me.
Yeah, no, because, okay, so Boltzmann doesn't work. We can discuss this later. Okay, so in order to get rid of Boltzmann, you have to construct some limit in which you can do an instantaneous in time approximation here in these integrals. And usually, there's some perturbative argument which allows you to do this. I cannot do this because I have this linear and new term, which has to do with the way I have set up my non-equilibrium evolution. Because I compare an integrable evolution to a non-integrable evolution. This is why you shouldn't expect it's simply Boltzmann. It's something more complicated. Let's discuss this later. Okay.
Take the free Hopping term, then in three dimensions it goes like t to the minus c over 2. In one dimension it goes like 1 over 0. Therefore, you know, you cannot do this easily with the instantaneous approximation.
Yeah, okay. But let me carry on because, so I have 10 more minutes, which will be just about fine. Five more. Sorry. I mean, okay. So now let's see what this method gives you. Okay. So we do some quench, very similar to what we had before. Some initial dimerization, final dimerization, and we break integrability. And integrability breaking is small, but not so small. And then here's the comparison of this equation of motion with T dim RG, and that will make Pasquale happy because what you see basically they agree perfectly. Yeah. Deviations are teeny, teeny, tiny. Okay, on all the available timescales we have with TDMRG. Now we can run these equations of motion much longer, to let's say 100 in terms of the hopping. And what you see is you see a beautiful pre-thermalization plateau. So this expectation value settles to some constant value, which is not at all thermal. The thermal value is this dashed line. So it's a nice pre-thermalization plateau for these parameters. So excellent agreement with the previous stuff. And now we have this pre-thermalization plateau also is there to much, much longer times. Okay. Okay, so large times is not 100. Yeah. So what we believe, once again, is large times will be thousands, something like this. Yeah. Okay. But this is one of the obvious questions. Yeah, so until when can you trust it? Yeah, but I cannot solve, and neither can you, non-integral models exactly, so you basically ride your luck. Okay, so now basically extend the model we study a little bit so that we can tune for constant strength of this integrability breaking term the size or the length of the plateau. Yeah. So in order to do this, we take one more term in our Hamiltonian, which is just the next nearest neighbor hopping. Yeah. So we put a bit of frustration in. And this extra term basically modifies the band structure of the problem and opens extra scattering channels. And this is why for constant interaction, you shrink this pre-thermalization plateau. And the other thing we do is the initial density matrix now we allow to be thermal. So we don't take the ground state of this free Fermi-Hamiltonian. We take basically if you wish, a general eigenstate of this initial free Fermion Hamiltonian, which corresponds to a particular temperature. So we do, okay, so first of all, I still have a Wick's theorem, so it's as good for us as the ground state was. The reason for doing this is it allows you to pump more energy in the system, which is useful. Okay, so now here is what we find. So now we quench, once again, from some initial Hamiltonian to some final one with a particular dimerization, particular integrability breaking term, and the initial state is some free fermion state at finite temperature. And now what you see for this observable we study as a function of time, there's no longer a pre-thermalization plateau. So there's some short-time behavior, and eventually you slowly, in an exponentially slow way, move towards thermal values. Yeah. So this is just one plot. So we have many, many such plots. So basically, if we make this parameter J2, if we don't have it, we just have the pre-thermalization plateau. So now if we make it larger, so we destroy the plateau quicker and quicker, and we start moving towards the thermal state faster and faster. Okay? And what this equation of motion stuff allows us to do is basically to fit the behavior, how this observable approaches the thermal state.
Slow exponential, you mean an exponential with a larger...
Here. Yeah, so basically all the data we have produced can be described in this formula. So the time-evolving Green's function is basically equal to some constant part, which agrees with the thermal value, plus some exponential in time correction. Yeah, and the correction here is e to the minus t over tau. Yeah, and tau, this decay time, scales with my integrability breaking term squared. So it's very, very slow. Okay. Now you can ask, well, okay, let me look at mode occupation numbers and see whether they also approach thermal values. Yeah. We can, but I have 1 minute left. So I will finish and then you can ask, because otherwise he will not let me talk. Okay, so here is basically just Fourier transforming this data for the Green's function. So let's look at the mode occupation numbers in Fourier space for one of the bands. So initially, so we have this red curve, yeah, and the thermal value would be the black. And this, all these different curves here basically show you what happens as a function of time. And what happens very, very, very slowly, these mode occupation numbers approach thermal values. Okay? And now I'm not bad. So here's my summary. As I just asserted in the first part of the talk, these integral models have unusual non-thermal steady states after quantum quenches. And if we add weak perturbation to an integral model, this generates interesting transients, which are called pre-thermalization plateaus. And what happens in actual fact, so these plateaus are not perfectly flat, so to speak, but expectation values of local operators, in fact, slowly drift off the pre-thermalization plateaus towards thermal values. But you simply cannot see this because it's an exponentially small effect before this crossover time scale. So this is basically what we have done so far. So now the obvious question is, well, can you improve on this method? So in order to do that, you would have to treat the higher cumulants. And if you could do that, then maybe you can even describe how you enter this thermal regime properly. But I mean, this is very difficult, so we certainly can't do that. And then a very interesting question, of course, is, well, can we do something analogous for strongly interacting models, like a spin model, like the Heisenberg chain with a weak integrability breaking term? So it's much, much harder, because in integral models, always all cumulants are non-zero. Yeah, so you never have this nice, you never have a nice principle that allows you to truncate some equation of motion type of approach. Thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that you work in the thermodynamic limit.
Yeah.
And so probably the order of limits is important.
Absolutely.
Cases,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this brings me to my question. So these times, relaxation times, Tij, how do they depend on the distance between the sites?
Yeah, they depend on the distance in the sites. I can show you some plots. I mean, basically what we can do is we study this at a distance 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 sites or something. And for each of those, we have some value, numerical value for these tau ij's. But okay, so we don't have a functional form. I should have said, effectively, we're always in the thermodynamic limit here, right? So to do the simulation, we put the system in a finite box, but we make sure we stop the time evolution before finite size effects, before the light cone basically hits the boundary, so to speak. Yeah. So finite size effects we have studied here, they're not there. Yeah, and we are always in the limit where time, the times I've shown you here, is much, much less than system size times divided by velocity.
Still, another quick question. So I guess many equilibrium properties of these systems would be probably described by Leitinger liquid, right?
Yeah.
So is that something that you can use to...
Well, we have tried that in some paper with Pasquale, for example. It doesn't really work, but we can talk later. So that basically breaks down pretty quickly. Yeah, irrelevant operators usually don't have small coupling constants at finite scales. So that's why you shouldn't expect it to work.
I just have a question on this sort of kinetic-like equation. I mean, you still keep the time integration. I mean, do you actually numerically integrate this equation? This is what you do, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, how large a system size do you?
We did about 400 sites, which allows us to go roughly to times of 300 or something like this before you have to stop, because the light cone basically goes around. Yeah.
So what happened exactly when you saw this 1 over t to the 3 halves to that plateau? Then this time scale 1 over u squared would just be much longer than where you see the plateau. Did you take so small u, or is the p factor?
So basically, you see what we did. Okay, so when for the parameters where you had this nice plateau, this exponential drift you would not see. It is so on time scales up to a few hundred. I mean, so you would not see simply because this decay rate because not because u is so small, because you have e to the minus t over tau, roughly speaking. This is proportional to u squared, but there's also some prefactor. And the prefactor depends on all the other stuff. Okay? Not by chance. I mean, so basically, in order to make tau small, I introduce this extra term J2. And that allows me, at fixed integrability breaking term, to tune this. And then I can put myself in a regime where I see the deviation from the plateau. Okay, but even if I have this this J2 parameter there, if I make u smaller, the integrability breaking term, you once again have a plateau. This was just a device to be able to see how you go off.
But it's not by chance so that when this J2 is 0, then the
prefactor
u squared is
0. No, absolutely not, no.
Okay, so let's save remaining questions for the break, and thank Vivian again for an excellent talk. Thank you.